Okay, good morning, everybody. We're ready to start. At least I'm ready to start. And I'm going to turn some of these lights down. I'm going to get those lights back up. Like so. Okay. All right, let's come to order. You guys are having a lot of fun. That's great. But let's have physiology fun, because if we look at the schedule here, all right, today is March 19th. This is Bio241, March 19th. We're going to have a lecture on autonomic nervous system, finish that one up, maybe get into sensory physiology, but we definitely have to finish up autonomic nervous system, because next time is test, exam number 2, chapters 4, 5, 7, and 9. 4, 5, 7, and 9. Sensory physiology will not be on the test, so we might start talking about it so we don't get behind. Okay, 4, 5, 7, and 9. Anybody have any questions, problems with Blackboard, anything like that? You're all good? Fantastic. All the lectures are loaded online. I'll try to get this one loaded up maybe late tonight, all right, so we can start studying right away. And recently I've been getting these lectures up almost the day of the recording. And that's helping some people out, because they listen to the recording soon after the lecture and fill in some notes. And that's actually very helpful. Right? So if you listen to the lecture over again very soon after the lecture is given, it will make a lot of sense. But if you wait 2 or 3 weeks and listen to the lecture again, it just doesn't have the same impact. Right? So try to fill in your notes, listen to the lecture again if you like to study that way, soon after. Right, I get it up on the internet. That's probably the most efficient way of doing that. All right, any other questions on the schedule at all? No? Okay. Autonomic nervous system takes care of most things in our body. As a matter of fact, there's only one thing that the autonomic nervous system doesn't take care of. Skeletal muscle. That's right. The only thing you have voluntary control of is skeletal muscle. Everything else is controlled by the autonomic nervous system or by the endocrine system or other kinds of control systems. All right. And so the autonomic nervous system is hugely important to maintain homeostasis. And what can you tell me about mechanisms that are so important to maintain homeostasis? What should their architecture be? Negative feedback. That's nice. That maintains homeostasis. Okay. What's another principle that control systems you can use to maintain precise control and balance over some? That's right. Antagonistic systems like triceps, biceps, for instance. Right. In the autonomic nervous system, then if you don't really know anything about the autonomic nervous system, but you understand how important antagonism is, how many divisions would you guess there should be in the autonomic nervous system? There are two, right? And you know their names, and you know that generally they are going to be antagonistic to each other, even though we talked about a couple other circumstances on the beginning of lecture last time. Okay, then we got into the anatomy a little bit. Remember, every autonomic, except for one, every autonomic outflow pathway requires two nerves to get from the spinal cord to an effector organ. What's the effector organ for autonomic nervous system? Glands, smooth muscle, cardiac muscle. Fantastic. And the effector organ for the somatic motor nervous system would be just skeletal muscle, as you told me earlier. Okay, so I did realize that the preganglionic fiber is myelinated and the postganglionic fiber is not myelinated. So here we have the preganglionic fiber leaving the ventral root, going into the dorsal ramus, and then coming in this communicant. So is this going to be a white one or a gray one? Yeah, this is white because it's myelinated, right? So here is the white ramus communicans, and then signals can go back into the ramus, leaving via the gray ramus, because it's going to be a postganglionic fiber going through there. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I might have said the opposite. Okay, so yeah, so for sure, the preganglionic fiber is myelinated, and the postganglionic fiber is non-myelinated, and that's going to be true for the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system. Right, so when this preganglionic fiber enters the sympathetic chain, it enters via the white ramus communicans. because it's a myelinated fiber. And then if nerves leave at that level, right, it's going to be a postganglionic fiber, and that's going to look gray. And so this one right here is the gray ramus communicans. Okay, and don't forget, these nerves can actually ascend or descend a level or two levels within the sympathetic chain. All right, so let's talk a little bit more specifically. We'll fill in some of that information. Okay, so sympathetic versus parasympathetic. The best way to think of these is that they're going to be antagonistic to each other. Sometimes one will be excitatory. Sometimes that same one will be inhibitory. The only thing you know for sure is that if one is excitatory, the other will be inhibitory or opposite. And that's usually always the case. Here are the ways that you should consider the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Sympathetic produces the fight, flight, or stress reactions in our body. So anytime you're in a stressful situation, the sympathetic nervous system is going to take over. That's the much more exciting autonomic nervous system in our body. All right, parasympathetic, all right, mediates rest and digest. It is excitatory on the digestive system. So if you're in a really stressful situation, you don't need to have a lot of blood going to your digestive tract. You need blood going to your brain, your heart, muscles. Right, and not so much your digestive tract. Okay, so when you pay hundreds of dollars to go see a movie someplace, which nervous system do you think is being activated? Yeah, definitely the sympathetic nervous system, right? So I'm sure movie producers even make physiologic measurements of people as they're developing different cinematic techniques. Right, because you're not going to pay all that money to go rest and digest in a theater, right, or fall asleep. Okay. All right, so remember that the sympathetic division is also called the thoracolumbar because outflow leaves through the thoracic vertebrae, right, or lumbar, right, from T1 to L2. And remember, for autonomic outflow, there has to be two nerves. There's a preganglionic and postganglionic fiber, so there has to be a ganglion someplace. For the sympathetic nervous system, there are generally two locations, right? One location is on either side of the vertebral column, right? We call these the sympathetic chain ganglia. Sometimes we call these the paravertebral ganglia. Para just means what? On either side, paravertebral. Sometimes the preganglionic nerve passes straight through the sympathetic chain on its way to a target organ, but it has to synapse at a ganglion someplace, and there's a secondary place where we can find ganglia, and that is anterior to these vertebral bodies. So sometimes we call those the prevertebral. So there's a big difference between paravertebral and pre, right? Pre is anterior to, and the prevertebral ganglia also have another name. Sometimes they're called collateral ganglia, because they aid what the paravertebral or the sympathetic chain ganglia do. Sympathetic nerve division is characterized by divergence and convergence. And what that produces is mass activation. Right? So when the sympathetic nervous system becomes activated, it affects all of the organs in your body, pretty much all at once. We call that mass activation. So here is a slide that shows divergence, right? So here is one nerve fiber going to many places, right? Activating many different things. So here we have the preganglionic fiber leaving the ventral root, right? Then getting into the dorsal ramus, and here's where it's mislabeled. This white ramus over here should actually be the second one. That's just a simple anatomy mistake. So it goes in, but nonetheless, they got it right. This is the white ramus communicans into the sympathetic chain. And notice this solid line is all from this one cell body. And so you can see this axon splitting, bifurcating, and bifurcating again. And part of it exits at the same level that it entered. So here's the postganglionic fiber. But that same preganglionic might arise a division or two before it synapses on a postganglionic fiber, or it can pass straight through to the secondary type of ganglia, which is in front of the vertebral column. We call this what, the prevertebral or collateral ganglion. And I see even another branch from that same neuron comes back over here. Right? And then you even see some of that same neuron descending either even further in the sympathetic chain. So this one signal from the cell body goes where? Many places all over the body. That's what we call divergence, bringing that sympathetic information or what we call sympathetic tone or activation to many places in the body. And if you think of all of these sympathetic nerves, basically everything sympathetic in your body gets activated at one time. So what else do I see right here? That's good for now. All right, the dotted line just represents the postganglionic neuron, which is not myelinated. Convergence, all right, I do see convergence here as well. So here from that preganglionic fiber, I see that sometimes it can pass straight through the sympathetic chain, making its way to this collateral ganglia. And here I see these two terminal branches coming back together, all right, to form just one terminal branch within the collateral ganglia. And these nerves, anybody know what these nerves are that pass straight through? So not the neuron that passes, because in this little yellow area right here, it's not just one nerve. There could be hundreds or thousands of nerves or neurons, axons from neurons right here. Remember, if we put a whole bunch of axons together in the peripheral nervous system, it becomes a nerve. If we put them together in the central nervous system, it's a tract, right? For sure it's a tract. But here we're in the peripheral nervous system. If we put hundreds or thousands of these axons together, that becomes a nerve, right? A nerve. And a nerve can carry information two ways. And does anybody know the name, the general name of these nerves that carry sympathetic axons straight through the sympathetic chain to a collateral ganglia? They're always going to be called a splanchnic nerve. Splanchnic nerve. Splanchnic carries preganglionic axons to a collateral or prevertebral ganglia someplace. Okay. Okay. Here is a slide that shows where the collateral ganglia are located. Right, so they're anterior to the vertebral column, even anterior to the aorta, and way back over here are the sympathetic chain ganglia. That's what this slide shows, and that's about all that it shows. But I guess the other thing it shows is that all these nerves right here form a network, a plexus, right? Because one characteristic of the sympathetic nervous system is that it is highly divergent and convergent. So this is where a bunch of nerves split, come back together again. Okay. There's one exception in the sympathetic system where there is only a preganglionic neuron and not a postganglionic neuron, and it has to do with sympathetic nerves that go to the adrenal medulla. And remember, the adrenal medulla is located on top of the kidney, right? And you should think of it as a modified collateral ganglia that's just positioned on top of the kidney. And the cells of the adrenal medulla secrete some compounds like norepinephrine. Norepinephrine, we said, was a neurotransmitter, right? And another compound, epinephrine, which is very similar to norepinephrine. Commonly, epinephrine is called adrenaline. Norepinephrine is called noradrenaline. And when an action potential reaches these cells in the adrenal medulla, the cells of the adrenal medulla, they're called chromaffin cells. They secrete epinephrine and norepinephrine into the extracellular space, and then they diffuse into a capillary. And then once they're in the capillary, where does this epinephrine and norepinephrine go?
The blood.
Yes. Once it enters the capillary, it goes into the blood. And once it's in the blood, where does it go from there? Yeah, everywhere in the body, wherever blood is going, which is basically almost every place except for maybe epithelium, maybe some types of connective tissues, right? So it goes everywhere in the body, carrying that sympathetic signal everywhere in your body. All right, and so the adrenal medulla also aids in stimulating in a mass activation role, right? Because it just goes everywhere in the body. All right, so how would we like to think of these things? We said that a compound that is secreted by a neuron is a neurotransmitter, right? And it just diffuses across the synaptic cleft and then it binds to a receptor. Does anybody know what a compound is called that is secreted by some kind of cell? It enters the circulatory system, travels to a distant location, where it leaves the circulatory system and then binds to a receptor at some very distant part of the body. Anybody know what that is called? That is called a hormone, right? And hormones are typically secreted by what? Endocrine glands, endocrine cells. So you could actually think of the adrenal medulla as also being an endocrine gland, right? And in this particular case, epinephrine and norepinephrine are acting like hormones. So that's actually maybe pretty confusing to a lot of people because, right, these things are coming from something that looks like a neuron, right, but it also sort of looks like an endocrine gland. And we know norepinephrine is a neurotransmitter, but in this case, it's kind of acting like a hormone. What are we going to call these things? All right, so epinephrine and norepinephrine, we're going to call neurohormones. Neurohormones. So here is a very important junction in our body where there is a direct relationship between the nervous system and an endocrine system. And in a lot of physiology, even anatomy classes, we don't study the nervous system separate from the endocrine system. We study them together and call it the neuroendocrine system. A couple other places in the body where that happens. Anybody have some place on the in their mind where there is a gland and it's really hard to classify it as an endocrine gland? Okay. Or if what it is secreting is a neurotransmitter or a hormone? Yeah, pituitary. Fantastic. Right, the pituitary, especially the posterior pituitary, oxytocin and antidiuretic hormone, have characteristics of each because they're secreted by a neuron, but they travel through the blood to get to where they're supposed to go. All right. So epinephrine is made by just methylating norepinephrine. And remember that the precursor molecule is the amino acid tyrosine, and then it's modified. And the reason why I have this slide right here is that we see that there is just a small change in the structure causes what? A big change in the function of these molecules. That's the importance of this slide. I won't put any of these molecules on a test and have you tell me what they are, but you should just appreciate that small modifications, changes in structure make big changes in what the function is. All right, so that's kind of a nice overview of the sympathetic nervous system. Let's go on to the parasympathetic nervous system. Parasympathetic outflow is not through the thoracic and lumbar regions. It is from cranial nerves and sacral nerves. Two totally different kinds of regions, right? All right, so that's why we call it the craniosacral division. I see a question.
Yeah, I'm sorry, not the last slide, but the slide right before that. You said the only place in the body where there are only postganglionic.
Okay. I'll reiterate that point.
Okay.
For an autonomic outflow pathway, how many neurons does it take to get from central nervous system to an effector organ? Two. That's right. And what I wanted to say here is that here is an exception to that rule, right? There's only the preganglionic neuron. And these cells in the adrenal medulla are not neurons, but they sort of function like the postganglionic cell. All right, so this sympathetic system to the adrenal medulla only has the preganglionic fiber, right? And that postganglionic fiber has been drastically modified. Okay, so that's what I mean by that one. And we got a nice slide that's going to show that. Okay, craniosacral division. The preganglionics originate from the midbrain, medulla pons. Those would be cranial nerves, right? Cranial nerves. And then from the sacral 2 through 4. So that's how it got its name, craniosacral. They also have ganglions. It requires two nerves to get to their target organ. Now, the ganglia are very close to the target organ. They're not near the spinal cord. They're not in just anterior to the vertebral column, right? And so they're called terminal ganglia. Terminal ganglia might be located right on the target organ or even sometimes inside the target organ. So the postganglionics are very short. They have very, very short axons. But the preganglionic is still myelinated. The postganglionic is still not myelinated. So terminal ganglia refer to parasympathetic nervous system. One important parasympathetic nerve in the body, probably you knew this from anatomy, is the vagus nerve. It's a cranial nerve. What number cranial nerve is this? It is number 10, right? X. Where's X? I don't see an X. That's fine, but you know it is 10. All right, so this is a cranial nerve, and we're going to trace. I see the vagus nerve, and we trace it, and it goes all over the place. Right? It goes to intestines, it goes to liver, it goes to lungs, it goes to heart. Okay? It goes to digestive tract. All right, and that's how it got its name, because people saw this nerve wandering around all over the place, and a person that wanders all around all over the place is commonly called a, not an hour time anymore, it's called a vagabond, right? So vagabond and vagus kind of have that same connotation. All right, so that vagus nerve innervates everything, okay, in the superior regions in our body, and the sacral divisions innervate like the lower half of the large intestine, rectum, and some organs in the pelvic cavity. Not very many. So most are innervated by the vagus nerve. So here is a good synopsis of the autonomic nervous system, right? So I can see here's the spinal cord, and probably I can see two main colors in the spinal cord that represent the two main autonomic divisions. So here we got blue, right on, blue. Okay, so we got blue, and I see blue in the midbrain, hindbrain, okay, and then in the sacral region right here. So this is what, craniosacral, blue represents what part of the autonomic nervous system? Yeah, the parasympathetic, and then I see a nice red region right here, and I see it coming from the thoracic and lumbar region, so this is sympathetic outflow. All right, and I also know this is sympathetic outflow because I see the sympathetic chain ganglia, and all these nerves from the thoracolumbar region enter the sympathetic chain, so hence these have to be sympathetic neurons. And since these are the ganglia, what I see coming out of the spinal cord have to be the preganglionic fibers. Okay, and then sometimes coming directly out of the sympathetic chain is a postganglionic fiber that I see right here, because it is a dotted line that signifies a postganglionic neuron that is not myelinated. All right, so I see a preganglionic and a postganglionic fiber. If I look over here, I see a preganglionic and a postganglionic. And if I look over here, way down here, I see a preganglionic and a postganglionic. And if I look over here, I still see a preganglionic and a postganglionic fiber, right? So that's the rule. Two neurons back to back with a ganglion in between. Okay, and what was that exception? What organ? Yeah, the adrenal medulla. So let's look for adrenal medulla and trace it back. Here's the kidney. Ah, here's the adrenal medulla. And I see only one part of the nervous system, or one part of the autonomic nervous system, going to the adrenal medulla. And that is, what is this red one? Yeah, sympathetic. Right, so most times organs have dual innervation from both the sympathetic and parasympathetic, but there are some exceptions to that rule. An important exception is the adrenal medulla. It only receives sympathetic outflow. And furthermore, how many, is there a postganglionic fiber in this setup, in this system? No. The preganglionic fiber goes all the way to the adrenal medulla, and then you should maybe think of the adrenal medulla as being that collateral ganglia way far away from the spinal cord. These chromatin cells secrete epinephrine and norepinephrine directly when they get the neurotransmitter from this preganglionic fiber. And we got to discuss what those neurotransmitters are. Yeah, that sympathetic nerve fiber, the preganglionic fiber, goes straight to the adrenal medulla. And so it's got to join a nerve, that nerve carries the information right through the sympathetic chain. What do we call a nerve that allows a preganglionic fiber to just move right through the sympathetic chain to, right, prevertebral or collateral ganglia? It is a splanchnic nerve. There are a number of different kinds of splanchnic nerves, but right, you should know that a splanchnic nerve is always going to be preganglionic sympathetic fibers. Okay, so that is the only good exception. Okay, and I see, what about the heart? Do you see that the heart is dually innervated?
Yes.
Okay, and as you can see, most organs are, but not every specific organ. Okay. All right, so here is a table which kind of lists for you what we saw on that previous slide. I see three columns. I see an effector organ, right? So this is going to be getting either parasympathetic or sympathetic information. And here is the sympathetic effect from that organ. Here is the parasympathetic effect, right? And so what you would usually expect is that these effects are going to be antagonistic to each other. Let's point out some other interesting kinds of things. All right, so sympathetic causes dilation of the pupil, right? And parasympathetic causes constriction. That's a nice antagonistic effect, even though they're two different muscles, right? But it's still, you should consider that antagonism. Okay, sweat glands. I see that the sympathetic nervous system, right, is excitatory for secretion from sweat glands, but what about the parasympathetic nervous system? Has no effect. All right, so sweat glands are not dually innervated. They can only be activated. They can't be inactivated very, very quickly. All right, and that's sort of the same with the adrenal medulla. Right, sympathetic effect is secretion of norepinephrine and epinephrine, but there are no parasympathetic fibers that go there. Right, so it's not under antagonistic control. Ah, but the heart. Let's look at the heart in terms of conduction. Let's look at rate first, heart rate. All right, sympathetic increase of tone increases heart rate. Parasympathetic goes to the heart. What's the name of that nerve that goes to the heart? That is the vagus nerve, right? So that is inhibitory on the heart. So this important organ, at least in terms of heart rate, is dually innervated. One increases, the other decreases. And does that kind of follow the fight or flight rule? Yeah, right, because sympathetic, you would expect in a stressful circumstance for your heart rate to increase. All right, but that's not all. That's not the only characteristic of the heart. Not only can the rate change, but the force of contraction can change as well. They're two separate kind of events. We'll go over this when we start talking about the heart, but I want to mention two words right now that you're not responsible for, but I don't want you to just flip out when you hear it the first time when we talk about the heart. One is called chronotropy, and the other is called inotropy. Chronotropy has to do with heart rate, right? Like a chronograph is a watch that you would wear, so heart rate. Inotropy has to do with the strength of the force of contraction, right? So they're two separate things. All right, so there are some nerves that go to the ventricle, and they are sympathetic nerves. There are no parasympathetic nerves that go to the ventricle. So again, the ventricle is not dually innervated. The sympathetic nervous system can increase the strength of contraction, but the parasympathetic can't cause a reduction in the strength of contraction of the heart. Okay, bronchioles. Here is something interesting. Let's go back to heart rate. Sympathetic is excitatory, parasympathetic is inhibitory. Now let's go to bronchioles. Sympathetic dilates bronchioles. That means it is inhibitory to smooth muscle, causes smooth muscles to relax. So here's an example of the sympathetic nervous system being inhibitory on an organ. And what would you expect then, the parasympathetic? Antagonistic and excitatory, and indeed it is. All right, so now why the heck is it this way? Does it still kind of follow along that flight or flight rule? Well, when a bronchial dilates, it makes it much easier for air to move in and out of your lungs. All right, so if you're going to fight or fly away someplace, it would be really good to be able to breathe more efficiently. All right, so in this case, sympathetic nervous system is inhibitory on bronchioles so that it makes breathing easier to do. Okay. Let's see if there's anything else. You probably want to just look over this table. Where was another example in that? So we got fight or flight versus what's the other one? rest and digest, right? So rest and digest, that's for the parasympathetic nervous system. So I would expect the parasympathetic nervous system to be excitatory on digestive processes, right? So let's see if that's true, which is what? Opposite than the effect on the heart. So we have motility, sphincters. How about secretions? Secretions. Stomach secretions. Am I in the right spot? No. Bronchioles, gastrointestinal motility. Okay, let's just look at motility. Oh, yeah, okay, motility. How would you want to think of motility? In terms of peristalsis, right? Moving material from one part of the digestive tract to another. And so remember, parasympathetic is rest and digest. Digest is the, right, is the key word right there. So parasympathetic is excitatory. And the sympathetic is inhibitory. Okay. So again, you can't always say, but kind of think of those basic principles, fight and flight versus rest and digest. And that will help you remember some of these things. And then in most cases, the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic is going to be antagonistic. Okay.
So the motility is regarding
peristalsis? Yes, peristalsis. So the other kind of muscle contraction in the digestive tract, remember there are circular smooth muscles, and when they contract, they prevent the motion of material from one segment of the intestine to the other, right? It will prevent movement of contents from the stomach from entering the small intestine. There's a sphincter that prevents entry of material in the small intestine into the large intestine. Anybody remember what that one is called? From small to large, there's a sphincter there. What's that called? Okay, probably know. What's the very last division of the small intestine? That's a hint. What's the very last division? It's called the ileum. Remember? What is it? Duodenum, jejunum, ileum. Ileum is the last one. Ileocecal valve. Good. I thought I'd give you a hint. You got it, right? And the cecum is the first proximal division of the large intestine. There's a sphincter there. So in terms of the autonomic nervous system, what do you think the effect of sympathetic would be? Would it be excitatory or inhibitory if you want to slow down digestive processes? Okay. Well, if you want to slow down digestive processes, you don't want material moving from small intestine to large intestine. So what does the sphincter have to do? Yeah, in this particular case, it's excitatory, right? So sympathetic is excitatory because it's inhibiting digestive process, right, of the sphincter, but not the muscles for peristalsis. Okay, that's all sort of interesting. Yeah, tricky, really tricky questions. Okay, well, now we're getting into something that's super important clinically, and that is neurotransmitters. Right, so now we know a lot about this autonomic nervous system. I can see cranial sacral outflow, probably in the same nice blue color, right? Thoracolumbar outflow in a very nice red color, right? That would be sympathetic. And let's look at some of these synapses. Now these are chemical synapses, not electrical synapses. So what is, since it's a chemical synapse, what does a preganglionic fiber have to do to send a signal to the postganglionic fiber? Yeah, it's got to secrete neurotransmitter, release neurotransmitter, exocytose neurotransmitter, right, because it's a chemical synapse. All right, so let's look at all of the parasympathetic outflow. So here is the preganglionic fiber. Here is what we call that terminal ganglia, which is very close to the target organ or even inside the target organ. The preganglionic fiber is going to secrete, what is a neurotransmitter? Yeah, acetylcholine. What about the sacral parasympathetic outflow at the ganglia, at the terminal ganglia? Yeah, acetylcholine. Okay, and all of these ganglia, right, then they have the postganglionic fibers. And the postganglionic fibers for acetylcholine could have two types of receptors. Anybody remember what the two types could be, two possible types? Nicotinic, I like that. And muscarinic. And I'm going to tell you that the postganglionic fiber only has nicotinic receptors. Only nicotinic receptors. Now, what kind of receptor was that? It was a ligand gated channel. Is it, can it produce depolarization? Can it produce hyperpolarization? Can it produce both? What kind of thing, what does it do? Acetylcholine binds to the receptor, opens the channel, sodium channel. Sodium enters the cell. That's the only action, which is depolarization. That's right. So nicotinic channels that I see in these ganglia right here are always going to be excitatory because there are no muscarinic channels right there. They're just nicotinic type receptors. All right, so action potential comes down the preganglionic fiber. That's going to stimulate an action potential in the postganglionic fiber. And what is the neurotransmitter of these postganglionic fibers? I see acetylcholine up here, and I see acetylcholine down over here. Right? So again, both of these fibers are cholinergic. They're not adrenergic. They both release acetylcholine on their target organ. But now, we have seen that different target organs may have different effects, right? So acetylcholine could be inhibitory on some and excitatory on others. How the same neurotransmitter, how can the same neurotransmitter have opposite effects in different organs? Different receptors, right? They're still of the muscarinic type, but depending on whether that muscarinic receptor is coupled to a potassium channel or a sodium channel, it will have different effects. All right, so if it opens a sodium channel, it's excitatory. If it opens a potassium channel, it inhibits that particular organ, right? And one really good example, which kind of, what organ do you know has a muscarinic receptor, right, because it's coming from this postganglionic fiber, and it is inhibitory? What organ do you know that receives information from the parasympathetic nervous system that inhibits that organ? And you all know it, just you're not connecting the dots up just yet. And that is the heart, right? The vagus nerve does what? It slows down the heart. So there are those kinds of muscarinic receptors on the heart that inhibit the heart and slows the heart rate down. Okay. And then the muscarinic receptors in the digestive tract are, okay, excitatory because they work through sodium channels instead of potassium channels. Okay. All right, so that's parasympathetic nervous system that I see right here. These are what? All these are cholinergic fibers. Acetylcholine always at the ganglia. The postganglionic fiber always has nicotinic channels, so it's always excitatory. But the postganglionic fiber might stimulate either an excitatory or inhibitory channel, and those are of the muscarinic type. Okay, so that's parasympathetic. Sympathetic. Thoracolumbar outflow. Well, I see ganglia in a couple different places. Remember, they could be in the sympathetic chain close to the vertebral column or maybe farther away like in a collateral ganglia. But we see that there's a preganglionic fiber. The preganglionic fiber is going to release what neurotransmitter? Okay, acetylcholine at this collateral ganglia. What about the paravertebral ganglia? The same. What about in the adrenal medulla? The same, acetylcholine. So all of these preganglionic sympathetic neurons are cholinergic. They release acetylcholine, and the receptors in these ganglia are also nicotinic receptors. So action potentials are always excitatory on the postganglionic cells because they're nicotinic receptors. All right, now here there's a little switch. Here is a postganglionic fiber, and what is in the sympathetic nervous system, and what is it secreting? Norepinephrine. That's right, norepinephrine. No longer acetylcholine. Right? So norepinephrine is the standard sympathetic type neurotransmitter. And what kind of receptors would bind norepinephrine? Okay. They are what we call adrenergic receptors. Two main kinds of adrenergic receptors are alpha and beta. Right, the two main kinds for cholinergic receptors were nicotinic, muscarinic. Two main kinds for norepinephrine, which are they're all adrenergic receptors, are alpha and beta. And we're going to take a look at those in just a little bit. So all postganglionic sympathetic fibers are what we call adrenergic neurons. Because they don't secrete acetylcholine, they secrete norepinephrine. Right, and then here is that strange sympathetic outflow pathway where there is only the preganglionic fiber, and it goes straight through to the medulla, right? And then the medulla secretes epinephrine and norepinephrine into the blood. So then these things act like hormones instead of neurotransmitters. All right, so what is interesting about the effector organs in the autonomic nervous system compared to skeletal muscle? Skeletal muscle only has nicotinic receptors. That's all it has, right? But the autonomic nervous system can have various kinds. So here is a smooth muscle, and I see it is dually innervated. I see some sympathetic nerves, and I see some parasympathetic nerves entering this organ where there are smooth muscles. And this smooth muscle right here, okay, will receive neurotransmitter from these swellings that exist along the axon. So each one of these swellings right here can release neurotransmitter. Usually we think of a multipolar neuron as releasing neurotransmitter only from the axon terminus, but that's not true for these postganglionic fibers. So sometimes we call these varicosities, and since there's a whole string of varicosities, we call these synapses en passant, a whole bunch of synapses right here. So let's take a look at this cell. Where is it getting information from the autonomic nervous system? From the sympathetic or parasympathetic? It is both. Yeah, do you see both right here? So let's zoom into this region. All right, so here is the axon from the sympathetic neuron. Here's the axon from the parasympathetic. Parasympathetic is going to release what neurotransmitter? The postganglionic fiber releases acetylcholine. And what about the postganglionic fiber for the sympathetic nervous system? It's going to release norepinephrine. This smooth muscle has receptors for both, right? And they kind of look like a type of receptor. Well, what kind of type of receptor does that look like? A simple ion channel? Kind of looks like a G protein coupled receptor right here. And indeed they are, right? And these are not the same receptors. The cholinergic receptors, right, are different than these up over here because these are muscarinic receptors. Up over here are adrenergic receptors. All right, so what does this smooth muscle do? It looks kind of confusing. Well, it receives information from the parasympathetic and sympathetic, and what happens? It adds these effects together, right? And so a smooth muscle can decide for itself whether it's going to contract, right, based on the information it gets from the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Right, contrast that with a skeletal muscle. Can a skeletal muscle ever decide what to do?
No.
It just contracts because it only has one neuron and it only has nicotinic channels. It always depolarizes. Okay, so that is something interesting about some types of smooth muscle. Okay. All right, so let's talk about adrenergic receptors. So this table is pretty important, right? And what were the two main kinds of receptors? Alpha and beta. Yeah, alpha and beta. And then, you know what, there's some subclasses of these alphas and beta receptors, and I know, but they're so important, and people in hospitals, nurses, physicians have to think of these things like every hour. It's really important for you guys to know something about this. Okay, so there's alpha 1 and alpha 2. There's beta 1 and beta 2. And I'm going to skip a discussion of alpha 2 receptors, right? Because they're pretty complicated. Maybe outside of class, if you want to talk about them a little bit, we can talk about alpha 2. But I would like for you to know something about alpha 1, beta 1, and beta 2 receptors. And these all respond to, they all bind norepinephrine. All right, so what was kind of the motif of why do we have different kinds of receptors for the same neurotransmitter? Yeah, to produce different effects, right? So as you saw, sometimes the sympathetic nervous system is excitatory, sometimes it is inhibitory, depending on the organ. All right, well, let's look at the eye. The eye has alpha 1 adrenergic receptors that cause contraction. All right, so when a muscle contracts, is it inhibited or stimulated? Yeah, it's excited, it's stimulated. So alpha 1 in this particular case is excitatory on smooth muscles in the eye. Let's go to another alpha 1 receptor, skin and visceral blood vessels, right? And that's they have alpha 1 receptors. These arterioles constrict. All right, so what's the effect of norepinephrine binding to the alpha 1 receptors in these arterioles of the skin and visceral? Excitatory or inhibitory? Excitatory. What was it in the first case? Excitatory. Let's look at another case. In skeletal muscle, blood vessels, they have alpha 1, right? These arterioles constrict. So alpha 1 is what? Excitatory or inhibitory? Excitatory. What were the first two? Both excitatory. All right, one more example. All right, and that is stomach and intestine. Right, it increases motility, increases contraction. Right, I'm sorry. No, that would be the parasympathetic. Sorry, we're sympathetic. So stomach and intestine, sympathetic is going to be inhibitory. Okay, but alpha 1 in these other cases we saw was excitatory. So what muscles in the digestive tract are excited that decreases the digestive process? Those are the sphincters, like the ileocecal valve, right? So in this particular case, the alpha 1 receptors in the sphincters of the digestive tract, right, are excited, they contract, and that slows the digestive process down. Okay, so what can you tell me, what's a general principle for alpha 1 receptors? They're excitatory. Yeah, they're nice muscarinic, and I'm sorry, they're nice G protein coupled receptors that are excitatory. Okay, well, let's look at, and I said we're not going to look at alpha 2. So let's go on to beta receptors. And I do want you to know something about beta 1 and beta 2. All right, and so here I see a beta 1 on the heart, increases heart rate and strength of contraction. So both the chronotropy and inotropy of the heart is enhanced. All right, so beta 1 is what? Excitatory or inhibitory? Excitatory. All right. We don't have another beta 1. Ah, but we have a beta 2. Let's go down to beta 2 in the lungs. Bronchioles. What was the effect of beta 2? Up over here, beta 2. Oh no, we only talked about beta 1. Beta 1 was excitatory. Okay, beta 2 and the lungs. Bronchioles dilate. That's because smooth muscles relax. So here we said beta 1 is excitatory. What about beta 2? Inhibitory. Right, different effects. They work through a little bit different mechanism. Right, but I think I want you to know that the heart has beta 1 receptors. Lungs have beta 2. That's really important how we treat people with emphysema, asthma attacks, etc. Any kind of heart problems as well because of these different receptors. How are you going to remember that the heart has beta 1 receptors and the lungs have beta 2 receptors? Okay, I don't know if you were watching what I did, but you have one heart, right? So the primary receptor there is beta 1, and in bronchioles, yeah, they're beta 2, right? And beta 2 are inhibitory, cause dilation of bronchioles, which eases or enhances ventilation. Okay. All right, so that's kind of just a nice synopsis of the slide, except for one last thing. Okay, all of these adrenergic receptors are G protein coupled. None of them are just simply ligand gated channels. All right, the beta receptors use cyclic AMP as a second messenger. So cyclic AMP levels increase in a cell when the beta receptors bind a ligand. And the alpha receptors use calcium as a second messenger. So that calcium comes from outside the cell, typically, when that happens. So a calcium channel, or calcium is released inside the cell. And that activates probably things that, like a protein kinase. Right, that run around phosphorylating different proteins inside the cell. All right, where does this cyclic AMP come from? This is sort of a review. ATP. How does ATP turn into cyclic AMP? Yeah, you take two phosphate groups off. There's an enzyme that does that. And you got to know the name of that enzyme. It's called adenylate cyclase. Adenylate cyclase. Yeah. Okay, so that's what makes cyclic AMP, and you should think of antagonism, so there should be an enzyme that breaks down cyclic AMP, right? The enzyme that makes it, enzyme that breaks it down. But right now, I only want you to know for sure the enzyme that makes cyclic AMP from ATP, and that is adenylate cyclase. Okay. All right, so here is another synopsis kind of slide. And I see two neurons in series or back to back. I don't see one neuron going to an effector organ. So immediately, what should you recognize on this slide? It is autonomic outflow of some kind, because I see a preganglionic and a postganglionic fiber right here. And I see two divisions, parasympathetic and sympathetic. All right, and I think I've talked about this already, but let's go over it one more time. Here's an exam figure. I don't know if the other ones were. Maybe some parts of the other ones were. Here are the preganglionic fibers on the top row. Second row are the postganglionic fibers. These are all chemical synapses. And each of these preganglionic fibers, doesn't matter if it's parasympathetic or sympathetic, release what neurotransmitter? Acetylcholine. That's right. Doesn't matter which way or the other. But acetylcholine can have different effects in different parts of the body, right, depending on the receptors, but not in this particular case, right? Acetylcholine is going to be excitatory always on these postganglionic fibers. Why is that? Because all these postganglionic fibers on these dendrites and cell bodies have nicotinic receptors, nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, and they always produce depolarization, which is always excitatory. Okay. All right, now here is the difference. The neurotransmitter for the postganglionic fiber for parasympathetic is acetylcholine, but for all of these sympathetic postganglionics, it is norepinephrine, right? So there's a big change. So we got cholinergic receptors for the parasympathetic system and then adrenergic receptors for the sympathetic. Okay, so this acetylcholine from the postganglionic parasympathetic is going to bind to a muscarinic receptor. What can be the effect of a muscarinic receptor? Can it be excitatory? It could be either, right? Just all depends. And I'm not going to have you memorize the different classes, right? But it all depends on what organ it is, what kind of receptor it is. Since it's muscarinic, it could be one or the other. Right? And pretty much the same for these adrenergic receptors. So here is one. Right, stimulates alpha-1 adrenergic receptors. Right, and when an alpha-1 binds the ligand, namely norepinephrine, what did we realize was the effect usually? Excitatory, right? Vasoconstriction, right, in blood vessels of the skin and viscera, right, because alpha-1 are excitatory. All right, norepinephrine going to a place that has beta-1 receptors. What kind of organ has a beta-1 receptor? The heart. What did we say? What was the general function of a beta-1? Excitatory or inhibitory? Excitatory, right? So that increases heart rate and force of contraction, right? Sometimes we call that contractility. Sometimes we call it inotropy. So norepinephrine exhibits a positive chronotropic and inotropic effect on the heart because it's excitatory. Another outflow pathway, right? Beta-2. What did we use an example for beta-2 receptors? The lungs. Okay, now the beta-1s were excitatory. What about these beta-2? Inhibitory on smooth muscle of bronchioles, causing them to dilate, which makes breathing a lot easier. Okay, so when somebody's having an asthma attack and they go to their emergency inhaler and they inhale this mist, all right, what do you think is going on there? Okay, what's going on there? There is a compound in that mist, which is a agonist, right? In particular, a beta-2 agonist. It's probably not exactly epinephrine or norepinephrine, right? But it binds to these adrenergic receptors, the beta-2, which then causes a decrease in that spasm of the bronchioles. And when somebody's having that asthma attack, that makes it much easier for them to breathe as a result. Right? Usually, that's the case, unless there's a lot of inflammation or other things going on. All right, so stimulation of the beta-2 receptors causes dilation of bronchioles, and it's very easy to get drugs in that space. Okay. Yeah.
Can you show the How can we know, you know, like, we know for sure that regalia, they, in other matter, they parasympathetic or sympathetic, they release the ATX, right?
I agree.
And for the second...
Let me just say, some people might not hear in the back. What you said was the preganglionic fibers
always,
doesn't matter if it's parasympathetic or sympathetic, always release acetylcholine. You're right.
And for the postganglion neutrons, why sometimes they release ATH and sometimes they release the neuroactive?
Yeah, if it's a parasympathetic postganglionic fiber, it just releases acetylcholine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't want to go into evolution, why that happened that way, why it evolved that way. And sympathetic releases norepinephrine. Okay, that is the general rule. Of course, if that's a general rule, that means there are some exceptions to that. All right, but generally speaking, you want to think parasympathetic nervous system neurotransmitter is acetylcholine, and for the sympathetic nervous system, it is norepinephrine. Okay, so... For parasympathetic, I think always is a good statement. For sympathetic, always 100% of the time is not a good statement. But by far most of the time. There are some neurons that secrete, some autonomic neurons, that don't secrete acetylcholine or norepinephrine. They're called non-adrenergic, non-cholinergic neurotransmitters. Nitric oxide might be one of them. Serotonin is one of them. But they're located in very few places in the body. Okay. Okay. Acetylcholine is the neurotransmitter at all neuromuscular junctions. Remember, that is somatic motor outflow, just one neuron. Those are all cholinergic. All right. All preganglionics in the autonomic nervous system. Do you know what that means? All preganglionic neurons? That's the first in that outflow pathway. And what about the postganglionic fibers in the parasympathetic nervous system? Okay. Cholinergic receptors have two types. You're familiar with these, nicotinic. And what can you tell me about a nicotinic receptor?
Excited.
Always excitatory. I don't know an exception to that rule. All right. And the other kind is muscarinic. And it could either be excitatory or inhibitory, depending on what kind of ion channels are coupled to that G-protein-coupled receptor. I think in lab, you block these nicotinic receptors with curare. All right, so when a nicotinic receptor is blocked by curare, what part of the neuron cannot function? Okay, what part of the neuron has receptors? Yeah, the postsynaptic cell, but in that postsynaptic neuron, in that one neuron, where are these receptors located? Dendrites, I like dendrites. Cell body. What about axon? No, not on the axon. So, when a neuron is poisoned with curare, what part of the neuron does not work? Cell body and dendrite. What about the axon? It's just fine. Doesn't care if curare is there or not. Right? But because the dendrites are poisoned, synaptic transmission cannot take place. Right? But if you stimulate that axon electrically or some other kind of stimulus, sure, it can generate an action potential. Right? But not via the synapse. So curare poisons just dendrites and cell bodies, but not the axon. As opposed to maybe some other compounds that you used that block action potentials. Does anybody know what compounds you used in lab that can actually block an action potential? Where do you have action potential? Let's think of that neuron. Where do you have action potentials? On the axon. Yeah. So curare blocks dendrites and cell body. Use something, right, that works at the axon.
Ether?
Lidocaine. Yeah, I like that. I use ether too. I'm thinking lidocaine, novocaine. These are sodium channel blockers. Right? Sodium channel blockers work on what part of a neuron? The axon. That's right. So if it's a pain nerve fiber, it won't be able to transmit information from the cell body to the axon terminus. Right? And so then there will be no perception of pain when that happens. right? But lidocaine does not poison dendrites and cell bodies. It is just the voltage-gated channels, just the sodium voltage-gated channels. Okay. Okay. So here is a slide. This might be an exam figure, but it just kind of underscores the importance of the two different kinds of cholinergic receptors. Right here is nicotinic. You know that these are always excitatory because when these open up, when they bind two acetyl, these are ligand, right, gated channels. When it binds two acetylcholines, it opens up. The predominant effect is sodium entering the cell, which is, you know that, depolarization, excitatory. Then over here we have a couple examples of muscarinic receptors, and you can see both are G-protein coupled type receptors. And sometimes they're inhibitory, sometimes they're excitatory. If they are inhibitory, right, when this receptor binds acetylcholine, it opens a potassium channel, and what does that cause? Hyperpolarization or depolarization? Hyperpolarization, right? And so that is oh, it says right here, hyperpolarization, right, which is inhibition. And in the heart, we have these kinds of receptors that slows the heart rate down. Other organs, right, have a different kind of muscarinic receptor, right, and it's still a G-protein coupled receptor. In this particular case, the potassium channel closes. So over here, it opened up, that caused hyperpolarization. Over here, it closes, that's going to cause depolarization because this positive charge is trapped inside the cell. Can't get out. Since this positive charge is still trapped inside the cell, that causes depolarization. Is that what I said? I hope I said that. Okay. Causes depolarization, right, which is excitation. So here we see the two different kinds of muscarinic channels. Depending on what kind of membrane protein is put in the membrane by that fancy nucleus, right, it can have opposite effects. Okay. This one right here. I think the only thing I want you to know about this, nicotinic receptors, where do you find them? Skeletal muscle, autonomic ganglia, and that's pretty much it. Okay? They are always excitatory. Opens some kind of cation channel. And then we have these muscarinic, and they can have opposite effects depending on where they are located, whether in the heart, smooth muscles, or glands. And you don't have to know anything about M3, M2, M5s, M6s, or any Ms, right? You just have to know the difference between nicotinic and muscarinic. Okay, that's it, quickly, for the autonomic nervous system. Okay, so who feels like they have to go back and review their anatomy of the autonomic nervous system? Yeah, not a bad idea, right? Because some of these things get really wordy, and you got to be able to follow what neuron we're talking about, what synapse we're talking about, okay? Without wasting too much time. You should have that under your belt pretty fast. Okay. Does anybody know enough yet to ask a question? I hope. Anybody have any questions? Okay, I just laid a lot of information on you. Maybe you can't even think of a question just yet, but I see somebody has a question. Yes. Right here. Okay. What I want you to remember about this one is that usually organs are dually innervated and that they're going to be antagonist. The relationship between the two different kinds of nervous system is antagonistic to each other. Okay? Because I see sympathetic and I see parasympathetic. And sometimes I see dilation, sometimes I see constriction, depending on what part of the autonomic nervous system it is. Okay. And if you look at that carefully, right, I think you should be able to think that, and just use that rule of fight or flight versus rest and digest to know what the effect of one division of the autonomic nervous system will have on that particular organ. Okay, so if we have autonomic outflow to the heart, right, and it's sympathetic, what would be the sympathetic effect on the heart? Heart, and does that make sense? Sympathetic is fight or flight. Okay, what's going to happen to the heart under those circumstances? You would expect it to speed up. Okay, so kind of rely on that to you can memorize all these things, but I think if you just remember that general rule, you're going to be in really good shape. And what's the general rule for parasympathetic? Rest and digest. Now, that could either be excitatory or inhibitory, but rest and digest is a good thing to think about. Okay, rest means slowing the heart rate and increasing digestive processes by increasing motility. Okay, sphincters are a little bit different. To increase digestive processes, you need to relax sphincters, dilate sphincters. Okay, so I would just, to really answer your question, just think of fight and flight versus rest and digest. Okay, unless it's really easy for you to memorize. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I went over that, I think, a little bit. Now might not be a bad time to look at those again, if I have them quick. I think I have them pretty quick here someplace. Right here. Okay. Autonomic nervous system actions. Predominantly, what is the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic? Antagonistic, right? So that's what we have right here. Like pupil dilation, pupil constriction. But that's not always the relationship. Sometimes the two divisions are complementary. They produce similar effects. Example would be for salivary glands. Both of these basically increase secretion of saliva, just different kinds. Right? And then here's a cooperative association between the two divisions. Like the sympathetic causes ejaculation, parasympathetic causes erection. All right, so both of those things have to happen at the same time. Okay, and so they don't produce opposite effects. So that's these two slides. Okay, and for singly innervated organs, I have what? Sympathetic. What about the heart? Only sympathetic neurons go to the ventricles, and it is excitatory. Increases force of contraction. Now there's another part on the heart, which is the SA node. Where's the SA node located? Is it on a ventricle?
No.
Oh, where's the SA node? It's on the atrium. That's right. So on the ventricle, it only receives sympathetic, but the atria receive both sympathetic and parasympathetic. So on the SA node, the sympathetic is excitatory, increases the rate, right? Because the SA node is a pacemaker. The parasympathetic also goes to the SA node, but inhibits the SA node that slows the heart rate down. So that's basically these two slides right here.
Question.
Yeah.
Sometimes in the book, I asked some questions about online.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dual innervation.
Yeah.
What?
Well, the autonomic nervous system has how many divisions?
Two.
Yeah. What does dual mean?
Two.
That's right. So some organs have?
Two.
Yeah, have both the what? What are the two names? What are the two names of the autonomic nerves that go if it's dually innervated?
Brain.
Who?
Brain.
Nope. It's either going to be sympathetic or parasympathetic. Those are the two. If an organ is dually innervated, it gets both sympathetic nerves and parasympathetic nerves. If it is singly innervated, it gets one. And it's usually just the sympathetic nervous system, but not parasympathetic. Okay?
Question.
Okay, yeah.
When you say with the anatomy of the ANS, what do you mean?
Oh, where does the outflow come from? Yeah, craniosacral versus thoracolumbar. You got to know how many neurons does it take to get from central to effector organ. You should know what an effector organ is, all right, because you want to think of those neurotransmitters and receptors, right? So I think the important thing is neurotransmitter and receptor. So you got to know something about the architecture of the autonomic nervous system and something about the effector organs associated with it. Yeah, it wouldn't be a bad idea to know the difference between a collateral and paravertebral ganglia, for instance. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's good. Especially those exam figures. I promise I won't put a different figure on the test that's not an exam figure. Okay. All right, so I want to go on to the census chapter, and that's really a fun chapter. All right, so I won't get too involved with the census chapter right here. All right, so this chapter is not on the test, but I want to just kind of get, I want to get started with it. I got to pull it up. Right here. We've got too many open, really good. Okay, so let's go back. Let's go back to the beginning. So here we're going to be interested, just like in the autonomic nervous system, receptors. Right, autonomic nervous system, we're really interested in receptors and the various agonists. The same thing for sensory physiology. We're going to be interested in receptors because in order to perceive something, you have to have a receptor for that modality. All right, so let's talk about receptors. What does a receptor do? Well, it changes energy from one form to another. Does that obey or disobey any laws of thermodynamics? It obeys, right? Energy can be transformed from one form to another, but can neither be created or destroyed. So a receptor, let me get my cursor back. A receptor changes some kind of energy, maybe outside the body or inside the body, maybe light energy, into the language of the nervous system, which is what? A chemical energy. What's the language of your nervous system? And it even says on this slide, but it's not spelled out for you. How does your brain talk to different parts of itself? In terms of what comes down an axon. That's right. Action potential is the language of the brain. So a transducer, a receptor, changes whatever energy that is, like light, into action potentials. We call that signal transduction. Right? And each kind of receptor responds to a particular form of energy. We call that a modality. Right, so your eye responds to light because it has photoreceptors. Your ear responds to sound because it has vibration or pressure sensors in there. You can respond to odorant molecules because you have receptors in your nose that can bind certain molecules that are in the air. And so every one of these requires a receptor. So how do you tell the difference? How do you appreciate the difference between sound and light, for instance? Especially since the language is the same. It's always going to be an action potential. Okay, frequency will tell you if it is a loud sound or a soft sound, a bright light or a not so bright light. But how can you tell the difference between light and sound? Because action potentials go to different parts of the brain. Okay, so no matter how you stimulate the occipital lobe, what will be a person's experience? I think maybe in anatomy you learned that the occipital lobe contains the primary visual cortex, right? So we stimulate the occipital lobe, you'll have some kind of visual experience. And if it's a proper signal from the eyes and you've grown up knowing how to use your eyes, then you can make sense of that visual information. You can see edges, letters, words, people's faces, things like that. Okay, but let's take those same action potentials and take them to the temporal lobe instead. Will you see things if action potentials go to the temporal lobe? No, they got to go to the occipital lobe to see. Does anybody know what primary sensory cortex is housed in the temporal lobe?
Hearing,
that's right. And so if those same action potentials from the eye go to the temporal lobe, then what will be your experience? You will hear something. Right? Light will produce the sensation of hearing because it went to the auditory cortex. Right? So that's what this statement means. Different modalities are perceived as different because of the different areas of the central nervous system that are activated by it. Okay. Some receptors that we have in the integument. These are what we call general receptors for touch and vibration, even pain and temperature. And so if I took a ice cube and I put it on your earlobe, could you tell it was cold?
Yes.
Yeah, what about the back of your knee? Yes. Where do you have temperature receptors? Everywhere in your body, right? And as a result, we call that general sensation. If you have sensation of a particular modality all over your body, we call that general sensation. What are some of these? Pain, temperature, vibration, pressure, touch, right? All right, so those are general senses. We can group sensory receptors into certain kinds, like chemoreceptors for sensing chemicals, right? So chemicals usually have to bind to a receptor by shape. Photoreceptors transduce energy in the form of light. We're going to spend some time with that into action potentials. Thermoreceptors respond to temperature changes, right? And what's one good way to think about that? Take some butter out of the refrigerator that's cold and put it next to the stove, which is hot. What's going to happen to the butter? It's going to melt. It's going to change shape, right? So temperature can change the shape of molecules, and that changes the function of them. Mechanoreceptors, like we just looked at, those Pacinian corpuscles, they have different layers of membranes, and when those membranes are disturbed, pushed and pulled, that can open or close different kinds of ion channels, right? And that can generate graded potentials, which can be converted into action potentials that go to the brain. Nociceptors respond to painful stimulus. Could be chemical, could be acid-based, could be temperature, some kind of damaging stimulus. And proprioceptors signal positional sense. So you have proprioceptors in all tendons and probably ligaments and all muscles. So muscles have something called a spindle apparatus that sends information to the brain how much tension is being produced or what the length of that muscle is. And there are similar kinds of proprioceptors in tendons that can measure tension, and that sends tension information to the brain. And so where do you have tendons? In one location in your body or many places? All over the place. Okay. So would proprioception be a general sense? It sounds pretty fancy. Yeah, because you have temperature receptors all over your body. That's a general sense. You have proprioceptors all over your body, so it is a general sense as well. Okay, thermoreceptors. So we started this characterization already, right? A general kind of receptor is because there are receptors all over the place on your body. If I took a pin and poked you on the back of your hand, you could feel it. If I poked you on your belly button, earlobe, whatever, right? So pain receptors are general receptors. As opposed to special sense receptors. Special senses, we have 5 of them. And in this particular case, only one region of the body is going to respond to that modality of energy. So for instance, if I have a flashlight and I shine it on your belly button, can you see that light? Your kneecap? No, you can't. Your elbow. Where can you perceive light? Only your eyes, right? So that's a special sense. All right, so special senses are only in one, maybe two locations in your body. Two locations would be, for instance, hearing and sight, I suppose, two locations, but they're pretty close together. So where are these special senses? Where can you taste something? Only your mouth. So that's a special sense. So the special senses, let's see if I can figure out what they are. They are vision. They are gustation, which is another name for taste, right? Gustation. Hearing, that's 3. Vision, taste, olfaction, which is smell. Okay, did I say hearing already? Yeah. Okay, so that doesn't count. Okay, and there's 2 kinds of equilibrium senses, right? There is a static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium. Those are located in your ear. One allows you to appreciate linear acceleration. The other one allows you to appreciate angular acceleration or deceleration. Okay, and those are in your ear, so those are special senses as well. Okay, receptors can respond maybe in 2 different kinds of ways. Some habituate, some get used to the stimulus and then don't send information to the brain, like all those pressure receptors that are on your body right now. They don't feel that you're wearing clothes. You don't get any of that information, right? But if there was a pin poking you during lecture, you would feel that pin poking you throughout the whole lecture. So one is called a tonic, the other is called a phasic receptor, right? A tonic receptor responds at a constant rate as long as the stimulus is applied, like pain, right? So here we have a bunch of action potentials. The stimulus is started here, and then 120 days later, the stimulus is withdrawn. During that whole time, that person experienced pain. Yeah, because this is a tonic receptor. As opposed to a phasic receptor. We apply the stimulus right here. The receptor responds, okay, with what? High intensity, because they see a high frequency of action potentials. And then what happens to the frequency of action potentials? It starts to go down. So what is the amplitude of this particular stimulus then? It slows down. Your perception slows down, even though the stimulus is the same. All right, so we call these fast adapting. And some of these things, smell and touch. I always have a really good example of smell. When you walk in a library, right, it always smells like a bunch of books, old books. And after you've been in the library for 15 minutes, you don't smell those old books anymore. Right? Maybe you can relate to that. Okay. And the same thing for touch. Okay. Loft-specific nerve energies, right, says that a receptor will respond best to its adequate stimulus, whatever the stimulus that it was designed to receive. All right, so, and what's the adequate stimulus for your eyes?
Light.
Would be light, yeah. The sense would be vision, but those photoreceptors are most sensitive to light. But they can still send action potentials to your brain, right, if you hit an eyeball. Right, if you hit it with sufficient force and deform the membrane, you will see stars, right? But the adequate stimulus is not vibration or pressure, it is still light, right? So the loft specific nerve energy just says that a receptor or the adequate stimulus is the stimulus that requires the least amount of energy to activate that receptor, okay? Not the most. So adequate stimulus is the type of energy, not the amount of energy to stimulate something. There is a question online for you. Well, you're going to get to that for the next test. So just remember, adequate stimulus is type of energy, not amplitude of energy. Okay, some classifications. All right, we're going to start here next time with generator potentials. You already know two different kinds of potentials, which will be on the exam. What are the two kinds of potentials potentially on the exam? Yeah, graded and active. And they're different, right? Yes. Okay. Yeah, these generator potentials I see in yellow, they look more like graded potentials. Yeah. Okay, so I'll see you guys on Tuesday with an ID, a photo ID. A pencil, a good eraser, and a nice clean Scantron. Yes, I know he's going around.